afternoon. There is a representative from Tuxuk Bay and another one from Nightmute, and they wanted both of them to make brief statements. They were at the community, or at least the village meetings we held at Tununuk last week, and they decided to come here representing their villages, and perhaps we might just take 5 minutes or so to hear from them. And would you escort these two gentlemen to the...
I'm a Thomas Simmel from Nightmute, and I just go for only fourth grade I got, and I'd like to have a testimony, short words. We are select the land back in 1971. Herod Anchorage, he sent us to select the land. And what about those kids born after December 1981? There's no stock, there's no land, no shareholder. But the law is wrong to me. It is our kids. It is not different from us. It is not like a white people. Or come, give us the law. And in 1991 is come for the taxation, and again back the land and the money and assets and. What about we have no land and money, and I've borne my life hunting and trapping. My ancestor teach me to use that land. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Jumbo. And would you, when you return, tell the people at Nightmute that we're very pleased that you were able to attend. Mr. Bill, would you like to add something?
Like that, just a little bit. My name is David Bill. I'm from Tuxuk Bay, Nelson Island, which is in Bering Sea. I was concerned about this. The other day, one man says about education. He stated that if a person don't have education, he's nothing. That didn't go with me. The native people of Alaska, the coastal village, even though the inland, who are all natives. Anywhere you look in Alaska, if Alaskan born native, educate his own children from the time they were born and from the time they were able to speak. They tell them what is wrong and what is right. As they say, the parents of the children are the best teachers they have, everyday teachers. So we teach our children how to survive in the wilderness, how to hunt for food, for fur, how to hunt in the ocean. These things, in the education you cannot give. You might give some of them, but you can't give all of them. Up to my age now, I'm still learning the Eskimo way. Nobody's never too old to learn the Eskimo way. There's no limit. They say, some people say they know the Eskimo way or the Alaskan native way if they stay for a month in their village. But they don't. They don't know a lot. They might know just a little bit. That's one of the things I want to say. The other one I want to add is tell you a little story about this person that I know. I won't give his name. He was taught by his father of his hunting ground where he'd hunt when he grows up to be a man. He learned all of them. He went freely, like a fox, like an animal. He went over, like if he wants to go over some place where there's food, where there's game. He could go freely at those earlier years, but up to this date, he was told he can't go no more without a permit. For that, what are our children and their children going to do if they can't go anyplace? How are they going to feed? Because there's no everyday income in the bush villages. The only survival they have is the land and the waters. And if you don't have if you're not working, there's only limited places where you can work. And if you're not one of them, the only income you have is you yourself. If you go out in a tundra or in the waters of Alaska, that's the only income you have for your village, I mean for your family. If you're sick, if you get sick, if you didn't get that much, your family starts getting hungry. So that's the main thing I want to talk about.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bill, and please tell the people at Tuxut Bay we're pleased that they sent you as their representative. Thank you very much. Well, Ann Reardon and Ralph Perdue can reclaim their seats if they wish. Well, we were going, when we adjourned, I had posed a couple of questions that I thought you might pursue in due course. That, of course, is up to you. But we were about to ask Lily McGarvey to speak when we adjourned.
I'm sorry I didn't write your questions down. I don't know what they were. But I've been told that there was a story in last night's paper about some of the things I said, and I haven't seen the story, but I understand they picked up on a joke I made about some of us couldn't spell corporation, and apparently the paper can't spell it either. But I hope that they give as much attention to what we said that we felt was important, that they do pick up on that. A few of us had a very lively luncheon, and there was quite a bit of discussion on David's question. And some of us thought that the question is backwards. Our land has always been used by us, and if we own it, I don't think we'll treat it differently. It'll still be one of the most important things to us. And if we have something of value, like right now we have the shares of stock and such, our traditional way has been to share. And I'm sure that we'll all share with our inheritors. I still feel sorry about those children that were born after the act, that they do not share in it at the present time, and I hope somehow we can turn that around. One of the ladies at lunch mentioned that her son was born before the passage of the act, and a daughter was born after the passage. So she has one that does belong and one that doesn't, according to the enrollments. Somebody mentioned education. Education does run through the act a lot. It was mentioned a lot. It's always been mentioned a lot. Education has been something that the Alaska Native population has not shared in equally with the rest of the population, in that a lot of us had to go to BIA schools, which were not as up to date, not as comprehensive as other schools. For instance, I was sent away to probably the first BIA boarding school in Alaska when I was going into the eighth grade. I was about 11 years old. And the BIA doctor told my father that if he didn't send me to the school that year, going into my eighth grade, that the school would probably be full the next year and I wouldn't be able to get in. So I sent to Eklutna to go through my eighth grade. And I was there at that time, as I said before, when you went to a BIA school, you were there until you finished school, which was at least 4 years, and you didn't return to your village all that time. Then if you chose to go on to travel to college, it was another 4 years. So a lot of us did not choose to go on to college. There was no college near us, and I myself had to travel 1,000 miles to go to high school. But the BIA arbitrarily made a decision that they were going to place students in grades according to their scores on a test that they were going to give every student in the school. Another girl and I made the highest scores on the test, so they were going to put me from my freshman year into my senior year. And I couldn't talk them out of it. I said, I don't want that. I want an education, a thorough education. Finally, I wrote my dad and told him about it and said, I want to go to school somewhere else because I can't get my education here. So he agreed, and I ended up going to school in Seward, going to high school in Seward, traveling on the mail boat back and forth in the spring and the fall, which I guess is lucky because I'm one of the few LUs that really went into all of the villages. We made 24 stops on our way, and I have met a lot of LUs. Although some of the islands are very close, there's no intercourse between islands because there's no transportation. I don't know how they made it in the past in the little Bodarkas, but in steamships it's hard, and in planes it's impossible to get to one island, from one island to another. Now you have to sometimes go all the way back into Anchorage and then out to the other island. But education is important, and I think that we need equal access to education, the same access that other people have in Alaska.
Thank you. Mr. Wright, did you wish to add anything at this point?
Yeah, I'd like to reflect again maybe on a few of the points that everyone's talked about in the last day and a half. I want to start with telling a little bit about, adding to a little bit about what I talked on before, the divisiveness of the system, the political system, administrations, and Congress. When the act, as it was written and approved by certain members of the Congress began to show a final stage. We were a few days or a few weeks from our annual convention, which was to be held in Fairbanks. So we had the House version and the Senate version, and we had our version, and we had input from a lot of people. And we had delegates from all of the villages in Alaska at that convention. And we couldn't divulge honestly to the Native people at that convention those negotiations that were underway by written agreements between the Alaska delegation, Congressman Begich, Senator Stevens, Senator Gravel, and other members of Congress that we were aware of, because if it were made public, we were told by our congressional delegation and by the leaders of the congressional committees and subcommittees of Congress that, quote, it would blow the whole thing. So we were sort of muzzled. We were instructed by these leaders of America that if we said anything about it and it hit the press, that it would cause chaos. So we honored that because of advice of counsel and advice of others, that was the way the system worked. The Native people have always been honest. They've always been out in the open. If they had a problem, they confronted those who they felt were causing the problem and said, hey, look, this is the problem, and here we are, and we want to negotiate a fair and honorable settlement. We don't want any fighting. We don't want any anger. We don't want any distrust. We just want to put our side out, and you put your side out, and we'll see if we can't negotiate something fair and honorable. We couldn't do that. As a result, anyone that was at that convention will recall, and there are video recordings of it, and there are minutes of it. The convention ended in chaos. And I, as the president and the chairman, in attempt to squelch the chaos, in an attempt to keep order, in an attempt that there wouldn't be blood drawn on the floor of the convention, literally, at fist fights, and in order to do something, made the decision to recess the convention. So I ordered a recess, and it was fully within my power, under our traditional way of dealings, as well as under the pressure of the modern the modern society. Philip Guy, whom is not here, but I wish he was here, is an Eskimo from the Kuskokwim, Bethel area, and he was my vice president. So in a challenge to my authority to recess the convention, he called it back to order and demanded answers. And I didn't blame him for that. You know, I would have done it myself, except that I thought the chaos might result in us losing a couple of 3 years. And we were near an end with a gun to our head of getting one step forward, a big step forward. So I stood my ground. They recalled the convention and conducted business. I didn't give in to my word to those congressmen and senators and those members of the White House whom were trying to help us, in my view. And I let it be as it was and let things happen the way they were. I was told by the White House that a bill would pass and that we had no say from that day forward. I didn't believe that. I thought we could change it. I thought there was true democracy, that there was true justice. The net result was that a bill passed, and we would stand in the halls of Congress before a subcommittee room or a committee room and wait and wonder, while representatives of the state of Alaska, senators and congressmen, cut deals behind closed doors that we knew nothing about and had no control over. When the bill finally passed, we talked to the White House and asked them if there was any possibility that we could review the bill before it was signed into law, that we could take the bill back to our people. And they said, do whatever you like, but it will not change anything. In desperation, we got the papers together. We made copies. The printing office hadn't completed its printing, and so we took bits and pieces and pieced it together the best we could and disseminated it to our people the best we could. And we called the convention to be held at the university out here. And I have to admit in public to all of you that I deceived my people. I led the leadership and I led the people of Alaska and the natives of Alaska to believe that we could have changed it. But I did it in good faith because the majority of the leadership and the majority of the natives that I talked to said, let's take the first step. So I pleaded with the White House that the president not sign the bill until at least we could convene in Anchorage and deliberate on the final draft that was approved by the joint conferences of the Senate and the House of Representatives. Again, they said, do what you got to do, but it's done. I said, well, it'd sure be nice if the president could address the native people. Even if he can't be there, if he could just address them and ask them what they thought and at least allow them to take a vote. They said again, we're sorry, but that isn't the way it works. I called the convention in Anchorage and I brought the delegates in and I explained to them what was going on, and they had lots of questions. What does this mean? What does that mean? And there was not time to explain it. The White House told me that the president was going to sign it on such and such a date, at such and such a time, no matter what happened. And fortunately, unfortunately, as history will show someday, the president signed the bill before the natives had a chance to really look at it. But in order to cover up, in the great tradition of the United States Congress, in the great tradition of the administrations of the American government, Mr. Nixon cut a tape. And I covered up too because I knew it was a tape. The President of the United States did not talk to me on the telephone. He did not address the convention directly on the telephone. He played a tape to all of us. I've tried to explain this to the Native leaders on and off. I disagree with those who say, such as Mr. Paul, as learned as he is, that to go back is impossible. Because the Tlingit-Haida had a settlement wherein they were paid 41 cents an acre. And it took them decades to receive that money. And then we rallied and went back in when they said, some of them, you can never do it again. And we brought the Tlingit Haida back into it, and we did it. We made one more step. Well, there's another day, and there'll be another step. And the indigenous peoples of the world ought to know how devious the Congress of the United States is, and how devious the presidents are and their men. And I'm not being derogatory. I'm a citizen of the United States, and I'm a citizen of the Native community. I'm not sure that I'm a citizen of this state, although I was born and raised here. And I've run for governor, and I've run for Congress and Senate. Never been elected. But when this land claims passed, we were plagued with congressmen, congresswomen, senators, men and women, staff members of senators and congressmen, staff members and partners and major businesses who got the Congress and the Senate, the administration elected in Washington, D.C. We're plagued with them coming to us and making offers and trying to deal. I've been approached by the biggest corporations on earth, and I've been approached by the biggest religious institutions on earth, and I've been approached by them all as I was president of the Alaska Federation of Natives. And I have to admit that I used a lot of them. As the president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, I used the churches and their influence. I used the unions and their influences. I used the major oil companies and their influences. And I used the politicians and their influences for one purpose: to take a step forward as an indigenous person. And it was for naught in some instances, but the result is what we're looking at today on an overview basis to try to steer in the future the destiny of those policymakers and those politicians and those corporate leaders and those indigenous people, future of other nations. And I think it's important to take a lot of time to go through this. I know what an IRA is. I've known what an IRA was for all of my life. My father was an interpreter and a good one, as Francis Degnan's father was an interpreter and a good one. They weren't interpreters of Russian and English and German and French. They were interpreters of the Inupiat language, of which there were eight or more who needed interpreters between them. They were Eskimo nations. There were 8 or 16 Athabascan languages that needed interpretation. The North Slope Eskimos couldn't really communicate with the lower Kuskokwim Eskimos. They needed interpreters. The Federal Field Committee report shows that. We characterize the Alaska sovereign people on an equal basing with those in all of Europe, wherein there are dozens of nations, sovereign nations, Norway, Sweden, France, Finland, you name it, Russia, big ones and little ones, like Mr. Opikson. His nation was large, his population was small. The United States is an amalgamation of rejects from those nations throughout this earth who came to this country to steal our land, and nothing has changed. The only thing that's changed is transportation is better and communication is better, and the control of indebtedness of the average American citizen is greater, so they can, instead of going in debt originally when George Washington got in and only had an expense account and didn't want a salary, from thousands to hundreds of thousands to millions to billions and to trillions, and we're going to go on from there. I don't know how big you can go with numbers and debt. A sovereign little Indian nation like Venati sits there. They don't owe anybody anything. They get no help from anybody. They got no monetary settlement. And who is trying to steal from them? Poor, impoverished people who have land. The state government. They're even taking the caribou meat off of their tables and the fish from their tables by regulations, insidious, invidious regulations, purporting to have the effect of law in the absence of statutory backing. There's a supremacy clause in the United States government that says that federal government and their statutes are supreme over the sovereign states, including Alaska, but they ignore the federal supremacy. Our reservations are not something that was given to us. IRA is not something that was given to us. We reserved the land. They didn't put us here. Sure, in the lower 48, they set up some reservations. They, through the Trail of Tears, ushered several tribes from the East Coast to the West Coast, put them into Oklahoma on, quote, reservations. But reservation is something we reserve for ourselves. That truly is culture, integrity, and that you can pass on. Now, we fought very hard with each other, and I am an issue in case. My father before me, my grandmother was born in Yukon Territory, Old Crow. Some call me a Canadian Indian. I'm not a Canadian Indian. I'm not an Indian. Columbus made a mistake. I'm an Athabascan. I'm a Crow. My neighbors are Nitsaguchin. My neighbors are Nupia. We're not Americans. We're not Alaskans. We're indigenous people. We always have been. We always will be. Our affinity to the land will never be taken from us. I am one of seven sons. I'm right in the middle. Three older brothers and three older younger brothers. When we wrestled with this legislation, the federal government and the state government paid experts to define us. Then they came to us and said, would you accept this definition of yourselves? You, in order to be an Indian Eskimo and Aleut, must prove by birth and by church records and by sworn testimony, signed witness testimony, that you are one quarter more Indian Eskimo or Aleut as defined by the church and by the state and by the federal government. We knew that that was impossible in the case of the Aleuts. We knew that that was impossible in the case of the Tlingit-Haidas. We knew that that was impossible in the case of the Inupiat. Because far before there was ever a United States or an America, peoples traveled. And I've had Koreans come to me and say, we are your descendants. And I have had Japanese come to me and say, you are our descendants. The fact of the matter is, we're all people of this land and will stay people of this land. As a result of the seven brothers, I married a part Eskimo girl, therefore my children qualify. My brother Gareth, the dog musher, he married Harry Carter's sister. She's part Eskimo, therefore his children qualified. But my other five brothers married white women and had more children than we did. So two out of seven of my brother's children do not qualify. Two families out of seven. My oldest brother had two wives, had nine children. Biologically, I'm married for the second time. I have four by my Eskimo wife and one by my Irish wife. Yet those children and those men and women, indigenous to this country, were denied their heritage, and to this day have been denied their heritage in the face of what I consider this unconstitutional, arbitrary act of Congress. There's nothing to say, no matter whom we are, that those children can't come back to haunt us, and that those people who are alive and well today, of my age, who are full-blooded, and I know several who are a full-blooded Indian, Nitsaguchin, who never went to a hearing in their life, who served in the military, who are veterans, who are members of the National Guard, and who do not show on an enrollment. Now, in this process, I had the privilege and the pleasure of going into Canada and learning about the Indian and Eskimo people in Canada and learning about the English law, status and non-status. You know, we're human beings. The issue that we face today and we faced then and we're going to continue to face is not one of will the IRA work or will the corporate structure work or will this work or will that work. The case is what President Reagan, bless his soul, and President Nixon, incidentally, bless his soul, call human rights. What are human rights? Where is the dignity of respect, man and woman to man and woman, no matter where you come from or what color you are? Where is that respect? And how far do we have to go, and how much longer do we have to try to sneak around to keep from going to jail and getting shot, getting assassinated? How long is it going to be? I don't know. I frankly feel very comfortable because I have 6 grandchildren and we're all reasonably healthy and getting an education, et cetera, and surviving, but that's got nothing to do with the integrity of sovereignty and human rights. I'm going to relate to you, and I know it may sound boring, but as a corporate individual, I ran for the board of directors of the Cook Inlet region and was elected. And lo and behold, and unknown to me, the governor of Alaska and some native leaders passed a law, invidious law. They call it the Alaska Little Securities Act, where in the state of Alaska, after the corporations were forming and after the Land Claim Settlement Act was completed, passed a law that said that any native corporation, now here the state is passing racial laws, any native corporation that has 1,000 or more stockholders must clear all proxy solicitations with the Commissioner of Banking and Securities. Well, at the time it happened to be a man named Julius Brecht, who was a Commissioner of Banking and Securities, and I consider him a Nazi, a transplanted Nazi. Julius Brecht took a letter of mine to my son, and he, as the judge and the jury and the executioner, attempted to have me put in jail on the basis that he said that my letter to my son was false and misleading in a proxy solicitation, because I and Jerry Ward said that we think that the coal in the Beluga fields, it's Cook Inlet property, has a value that would make every native in the Cook Inlet region have a value from the coal alone of over $350,000 per person. Jerry Ward and I researched out those figures, and we got those figures from a study that was done at great expense to the state of Alaska through the Commissioner of Natural Resources to give the state an estimate of the value of the coal within the Beluga fields before the Indians got their hands on it. And during court proceedings in which I employed personally 3 lawyers, including Ed Boyko, the Attorney General for the United States under the Hickman, for the state under the Hickman administration, Clifford Grove, former President of the Finance Committee, and 2 others, I was able to defend myself, but I went bankrupt. And they didn't put me in jail, but then the people that I defeated on the board of directors fight, Debbie Fullenwater and those girls from Cook Inlet, went to the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska without my knowing it, and got the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska to rule that the judge that heard the case that said there was no prima facie evidence convicting me of false and misleading information said that the proxies were still invalid. Therefore, I could no longer be on the board of directors. So the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska threw me off the board of directors of Cook Inlet Native Association. Now, I'm not bitter about that. I expected that. That's not the only case. What has happened is this. The major lawyers, the major corporation management personnel infiltrated our ranks and convinced some of our leadership that they ought to ignore the people and go for money-making propositions. And I don't begrudge them for that. But those leaders don't know how to spell sovereignty, let alone corporation. And they're being led around by the nose by corporate officials and state officials and churchgoers and church leaders, and I'm not down on any of them. I'm just simply saying that you want an overview of the past and the present. That's the way it is. My recommendation is that, yes, IRAs are the best possible thing. The North Slope, in 71, passed a region, I mean, got the Interior Department to let them form a regional IRA, but I don't know if they said it or not, but each of the villages had an IRA. Point Hope has an IRA. Barrow has an IRA. They all have IRAs. But then they piled on top of that a regional IRA. Mr. Hope tried to get the Venati to change their constitution and bylaws. He just testified here that, and he was a tribal rights officer. He testifies here and Mr. Paul also testified here that was the first time that they went more than one village or more than one government into a regional IRA, Tlingit Haida notwithstanding. Well, the fact of the matter is that Venati is a multiple IRA. I mean, the Venati was an IRA made up of Venati, Arctic Village, Katchik, and Roberts Fish Camp, Venati Landing. So whether there's one or two or 10 people or a million people in a village is a village if there's anybody in it. So we're made up of five villages, and Mr. Hope refused to give us services in many instances or advised the Interior against giving us services unless we modified our constitution to, instead of our legal given name was Native Village of Venati, which included five villages. Change it to villages. We argued about the amendments for quite some time, and it finally came down to a point where Mr. Hope came up to a meeting and said, let's take it, just change the one letter, S. But I knew if we did that, we would have to get permission of the secretary because it's an amendment. So I advised the tribe, don't change one letter, not one I, not T. If they don't know how to spell corporation in that document that the Secretary of the Interior, the President of the United States signed, don't change it. You know, we're not here to judge them. Whatever, that's a step. Don't change it, because if you do, talk about opening up a bucket of worms, they'll never let you do anything. The comment on whether you can dispose of land as an IRA, well, I disagree with Mr. Paul. Mr. Paul says, well, the Orthodox. Well, I don't know what that word means, but I know that a sovereign can do anything they want. The major protection of a sovereign, such as an IRA, is that they're immune from encroachment and suit without their permission. And sure, it's a disadvantage to be able to say, I mean, it's a disadvantage when you go to a bank and say, well, look, I'm not going to give you a chance to touch the land. And the bank says, go away. But we don't care. Because if the banks don't want to deal with us, wait till we do get a resource. They'll come and deal eventually. We're in no hurry. We're not going to jeopardize the integrity of the land under any circumstance until we unanimously want to do it as a government. And we're going to form alliances. IRAs in Alaska, IRAs or whatever traditional form of government in Canada, whatever traditional form of government in Norway or Sweden, whatever. It's my understanding, and if anybody here can correct me if I'm wrong, please do. It's my understanding that you cannot buy land in Norway unless you're a son of Norway. A woman cannot own land. No one else foreign can own land. The only one that can own land in Norway is a Norwegian or a son of Norway. Yet, I don't know for a fact, but I doubt very much if all Norwegians are blonde and blue-eyed. You know, I think there's some darker people up there and lighter people and red people and other kind of people, and they're still Norwegians, right? So when you identify yourself as a indigenous person, you identify yourself to those whom you love and relate to and whom are fathers and mothers and grandfathers and grandmothers of your children, whom chose to live under a sovereign condition which is known in the Western world as culture, heritage, culture and heritage. But you come to live on that land and be a person like that. I know lots of people. Uppixton knows, what was our friend up there, that's Hugh Nichols. He spoke Eskimo better than most Eskimos. He ate the food and he wore the clothes and he fought hard in this land fight. He's not a member. Matter of fact, they kicked him out because he was born in Minnesota And up until the passage of the Act, everybody thought he was an Eskimo. You talk about those that came in and became Indians after the Act. Well, don't forget about those that got thrown out because they weren't Indian after the Act passed, but they're the ones that did the majority of the fighting. I mean, what the heck? So it's back to Frank Degnan's good stories. The problem with us is we've had poor immigration laws. I really want this overview commission to consider, as we go through these hearings, to consider give some time to viewing of videotapes of the past and to viewing of the corporate records and the tribal records of the Alaska Federation, Native, and so on and so forth. I think it's very important, and it'd be very enlightening to everybody that is interested in what happens after such an act passes in the implementation on the basis of the dreams and aspirations of the people who are intended to be served. And I just think for the record that that stuff ought to be made a permanent part of the record. I can think of all kinds of things to say, but I just want to bring some of these things out and point out clearly that this is just another step. We have not given up our sovereignty. We have not given up our cultural values, and we have not given up our identity, and we never will. You don't have to own land to be a Native, but it's sure nice to know that you have retained some of it and fought hard enough to prevent them from taking it away from you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Wright. I was going to call on Francis Degnan next, and then Mr. Hope, if that particular story about Venetai is one to which you wanted to add anything, and then Mr. Ewan and Mr. Tiolana. But before we go on, I think it should be understood that in this commission we can't conduct an inquest into disputes that occurred in the past within